Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The lady who was responsible for the gymnastics, they just came with a few tablets and they were all loose and they said, take one each day. They didn't say what they were for. And back in the days, what do you do? It's an autocratic system where you do what you're being told.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
Circa offers a comprehensive exploration of life in East Germany, detailing the experiences of growing up in Neubrandenburg, the influence of the East German state and the Stasi, and the societal impacts of Mikhail Gorbachev's policies leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall. She also talks about her intensive gymnastics training and being given pills by her trainer. Circa describes the transition to reunification, highlighting the challenges of adapting to a new economic system and the mixed feelings towards sudden exposure to Western consumer culture. Additionally, it includes a reflective conversation on post-reunification life in Germany, discussing Circa's and her family's adjustment to the changes, including the effects on employment, home ownership, and personal political histories. We delve into the complexities of navigating the new Germany, touching on nostalgia, the emotional impact of revisiting childhood places, and the decision not to explore their Stasi files. I'm delighted to welcome Circa to our Cold War conversation.
So I was born in 1972, and it was in a town called Neubrandenburg, which is in the northeast of Germany, and even in the northeast of East Germany, if you want to. And it's now in the Bundesland Mecklenburg-Vorpommern.
And who was in your family?
I had obviously my mum and dad and a sister that was, she's 4 years younger than me. So all four of us, we were living in Neubrandenburg.
And what did your mum and dad do for a living?
My dad was a teacher at school and my mum a veterinary engineer.
What was Neubrandenburg like?
It's quite a young town in comparison to some others, if you think of even Berlin or Dresden or Magdeburg, all these big cities. So it was quite a youngish town. So we had the centre, which is fortified, and then the town grew. And then we had sort of satellite areas around it where they built new estates. And we were actually then moving onto one of these new estates when I was about 6.5 years old. So that was quite exciting then to go from a smaller apartment closer to the city centre into a bigger one. And we were lucky enough to have the balcony to oversee actually the rest of the town. So that was quite nice.
So this was a Plattenbau, was it?
Yeah, of course it was a lovely Plattenbau.
What other type was there as far as new builds in East Germany? I've yet to come across anything other than Plattenbau. I mean, your parents, did they have any experience of World War II or any of their relatives? I mean, sometimes I come across guests where their parents were, exiles from the even further eastern part of Germany that was there prior to the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm. Well, my Mum's parents went through the Second World War, but unfortunately I never met them because they passed away before I was born. However, on my father's side, yes, he was actually born in the war, sort of, yeah, 42, quite middle-ish, if you want to. And he obviously remembers some bits and bobs more when the war was over and the transition time was before the wall was built. And to be quite honest, even though it was encouraged at school in East Germany to ask our grandparents about World War and what they have lived through so that we don't forget, I think it's a bit like we do on the 11th of November when we say, lest we forget, so that the memory stays there. However, every time when I visited my grandparents, because they lived in Dresden, which was about, 800 kilometers of that away from where we were, they never really wanted to talk about the war. I think it was just what they must have seen, I'm just assuming, and lived, must have been quite dramatic that they didn't want to relive it. I know that my dad's uncle was in the war and served in France, and he just told snippets about the time he wasn't there, but I never got the whole picture. So he just said a couple of stories where he was chased by a plane and he had to run over the fields to get himself safe. And he had quite fond memories of France itself from the culture he's been able to experience. But other than that, I have to say, I don't know too much. You know, when you read the books, with all the horror of what has happened, they didn't really want to go into that.
Yeah, don't necessarily want to relive
that
time. Did your father share any detail on the sort of hardships they faced post-war with trying to rebuild the country?
He did. He remembers when he was younger being in those shelters as well, because obviously in Germany we've got quite a lot of cellars, especially on these old buildings in Dresden. And even though he was born in Dresden, they moved to Berlin. I can't quite remember what time it was. So some memories were even potato peels were not chopped away. His mum made the soup of it. So everything was utilized and the last nutrition was squeezed out of it, if that makes sense. And then when I asked him a couple of weeks back, if he remembered from the time when he grew up in Berlin, and he kind of remembered and he told me a story where he was near what now the border is, or was, sorry, I'm thinking back between East and West. And even though it was then already the Deutsche Demokratische Republik, they obviously had the East German money. So when they went into the West, my grandma was then asking, do they accept the mark, the East mark? And so they could buy some shoes or some clothes and that kind of thing. And then I think one story was he liked, I don't know if you probably know, it's called Vlock chocolate. And it's actually with the lettuce as well. You can break it off. And you normally use it to make a coating for a cake. So it's not the greatest chocolate, to be quite honest, but he quite liked it. And when they were walking in the street, he was telling me, and he said, oh, can we get some block chocolate? And his mom was just saying, shh, be quiet. People don't eat that type of chocolate. That is just for baking. So it kind of highlights, yes, obviously, it showed then that not everything was available in Eastern Germany in comparison to the West, so that they always crossed over to go and shopping. And then once the wall was built, that was it. There was definitely the divide.
What was your parents' view of the East German regime? Did they believe in it? I mean, I can imagine, you know, if you move to a new flat, a big new flat. And also, I think people forget you've no idea the Berlin Wall's going to fall in 1989.
No.
So therefore, you think this is going to be the rest of your life in this country. What was their view of the East German government and what they were doing?
There's one thing I remember my dad saying when they were living in Berlin and his dad was asked to help and join the ministry to rebuild Germany. And he actually then declined the job. And then that was more or less the trigger point for them then to move back into Dresden. Because my granddad was an engineer I can't remember if it was mechanical or something, but in the industry. And he just said, you can't bake bread with politics. So that he already realized that early on, the way they are trying to do it it's not going to work in the long run. And he didn't feel comfortable with it. So going back to my mum and dad, well, my mum was born just after the war, 47. So mum was never really politically engaged or anything. She just did her job and obviously looked after us. Where dad in East Germany, unfortunately, if you wanted to progress and have some career progression, you had at some point to be a member of the parties. And with being a teacher and obviously ambitious, he then joined the party to progress his career. But quite early on, when we moved into that Plattenbau at six, you don't have the understanding at that age. As I grew older and sort of early teens, I realized, hang on, something is not quite right. And we did speak quite openly in the house, but always careful because you never knew who was listening. Even then, already people suspected that people were listened to. And my dad obviously started criticizing to a degree the regime, but not too much so that we go back into school and say, oh, my dad said it. And he didn't really believe in it, but that was the catch 22. If you wanted to progress, you had to do it. And I think sometimes you just have to, you know.
You keep your head down and you toe the line and just get on with it.
Yeah.
No, I can completely, you know, understand that. Did you have any relatives in the West that would come and visit?
We did have some relatives in the West, and that was my granddad and great uncle's sister. She lived in West Berlin and then obviously had her family. We didn't see them very often. We only saw them a couple of times when we had family gathering at my grandparents in Dresden. And we didn't really get, you know, many best paket, as we called it, you know, parcels coming from the West. So I only got every now and then a bit of the chewing gums and the bubbles, you know, in that long plastic wrapping of my grandma. So we never really got much from them. And because of my dad's position, he had to be careful as well, not having too much contact with the West, because that was obviously not well received. Other than that, yeah, I think they had discussions as well about politics, but I was just too young to understand what was actually going on, because it was quite simple in East Germany. I think now, looking back as an adult and having lived in two different regimes, it is easier. It sounds weird, but when you're being told what to do and you just do it, and as a child, it's just as if it's another parent layer. And you just follow what you do, because you're not being educated of having your own mind and asking and questioning things you are seeing, you're hearing. But even at my grandma's, she was lucky to have a telephone at the time, which again was a massive luxury for people. And I always remember they were covered with blankets and cushions and all sorts. And when the discussions got a bit heated, it always went, just be quiet, you know, don't shout so much. So there was always this fear factor that somebody might listen or something might have been hidden, that people were listening. Or you, like afterwards, you never know who was actually in there, even from your own family, who then passed information on.
How long did you manage to make that bubblegum last?
Oh God, I can't remember. I think it kind of fell almost into pieces. And you really used it just one every now and then, because it was such a special thing to have. And they did taste better than the ones we had.
So your father's a teacher. I mean, you know, reasonably paid jobs, I guess. Did you have a car?
No.
A Trabant?
No, we didn't have a car, because even though both of them passed the driving license and applied for a car, as you probably remember from some other people speaking to and reading, it took a long time to get your hands onto it, even whatever car. So they were still waiting. So both of them had applied for one. I think my mum asked for a Skoda and my dad applied for a Wartburg. And when the wall came down, we still didn't have the car. We were still waiting. Okay. So he showed me actually the piece of paper where they had to confirmation that they were on the waiting list for a car. So no, we never had the luxury of the cars, which is in one way, Ian, not a bad thing, because it taught me independence. I had to use the bus to get around in Neubrandenburg. Then when I went to college, I had to take the train. So you learned to stand on your own feet quite early, reading those timetables and making sure you're catching the trains and the connections, unless I see it nowadays when kids are being chauffeured everywhere by the parents.
Yeah. You've reminded me of that classic East German joke where somebody's put their name down for a Trabant. They're told, you know, it'll be the 20th of January in 20 years' time. And so the person who's applied says, is that morning or afternoon? And the other person says, well, why do you need to know that in 20 years? And the son answers, because I've got the plumber coming in the afternoon. One of my favourites, that one.
Yeah,
and you've probably heard it before, circa.
I actually hadn't, but yeah, that's a good one. I shall remember that.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
So if you were going on holiday, presumably you're going by train.
Yes.
And so was that up to the Baltic coast generally where you went on holiday, or did you go further afield?
No, we usually went either down to see the family in Dresden, or we went up to the Baltic coast. And there, through my mum's company, they had little sort of static caravans, but not what they look like nowadays, but they were all sort of cardboard, you know, enforced cardboard kind of things, which you could move around. So that was then the static one we stayed in, which was very, very basic, but it did the trick.
And I think you had an interesting way of getting your luggage to
Yes.
your holiday destinations.
Well, because obviously with two children and you're going for a fortnight, such a destination, you can't trundle around. Back then, we didn't have wheels on the suitcases. So what we had in East Germany, it was called a Postmietbehälter. So it's literally what it says in German, if you were to translate it literally, is a container which you rent from the post, from the local post office. And it's a really, really strong fortified cardboard box with a lid. So you packed all your clothes in there, wrote the address on where it went to, where it was sent from, and you send that a couple of days earlier. So when we arrived at the destination, we just went to reception and then collected our Postmietbehälter, you know, like towels, bedding and all that sort of thing was in there. And then we did the same again, where you packed it all, and then it came back to your home. And I remember one year, it took a bit longer to get there. So we actually arrived, but the Postmietbehälter hadn't arrived yet. So we didn't have any towels, we didn't have any bedding. And I think it arrived about 1 or 2 days later. So that was a bit of a pickle, being there and not having all your necessary items. Yeah.
I quite like the idea of sort of like traveling without loads of luggage, but yeah. But you'd be worried about a scenario that you've just described there. Well, I guess people have that happen anyway nowadays when their luggage gets lost by the airline or something like that. So if you're coming back from Dresden by train, did you go the train goes around Berlin
Yes.
rather than through it because West Berlin's in the way?
Yeah.
Could you see much of West Berlin on that
No.
journey?
No, we couldn't really. And you weren't that close to the wall either with the train line. So you just knew you're going round now, and you always tried to have a peek in the hope of seeing something, but you didn't. But that makes me, I remember now, Ian, as well, 1 year we actually stayed for a week in Berlin, and it was a flat we stayed in. I can't remember how it came about. It must have been someone mum and dad know or knew back then. And that flat was actually really close to the wall. And it was, I think, in a second or third level. So you could actually see a bit rather than just being on the ground floor. And you could see the wall and you could see the no man's land. And you could actually have a wee peek into it. Not obviously seeing everything, but this stretch, this no man's land. And it was good because having seen it for real, rather than just later on in books or films or whatever. And it was quite weird. I can't remember how old I was. I must have been either 10 or 11 or something around that age. And it was quite shocking, actually. You know, when you look at it and you think, and you've heard about those people who were trying to escape and then got shot. And I think it started then already, where you start thinking, well, why do people want to leave and why do they shoot them? And it just didn't make much sense, to be quite honest. And yeah, it was quite impressive.
Could you see the people in West Berlin, or just the wall and no man's land?
You could just see army people, predominantly East German army people. That was it. No, you couldn't really see into the city. So I have not seen West Berlin until the wall came down and then went into there.
Yeah, we'll come on to that, your first experiences in the West. So in the Plattenbau, did you get on well with your neighbours?
That was really well, because the area where we moved to, it was all young families. So the whole Plattenbau, there was obviously loads of families with children, and we had preschools as well in our area. So we were all friends, and obviously most of them, we went to the same school. If it wasn't the same class, it was then, as we call it, the parallel class for the same year. And we always walked together. So yeah, the neighbours knew each other, and they were all helping each other as well if you ran out of sugar or flour or whatever, you know. Like, it reminds me a bit what I hear of people just after the Second World War. So there was that community, there was that helping out a lot. And it felt a lot more, I don't know, warmer, because you knew the people, you spoke to them. When nowadays, when I go back, I don't know any of those neighbors anymore. Well, obviously I'm not living there, but I don't think it's the same community anymore as it used to be back then. So yeah, it was quite nice. And we still went to school on Saturdays. And I still have a fond memory when you came back, especially in spring, and you then saw, obviously, windows wide open, the bedding was out, you heard the hoovers going left, right and centre, it smelled of various foods because the mums were cooking for lunch. And then the dads, where they had the car, they were doing something on their cars. And it just was nice, you know, seeing it being all that busy. That was always a nice way into the weekend.
And I guess the 70s is sort of the almost high point of East Germany, as far as, I'm trying to think of a way to word this, as far as, you know, consumer goods and life, and, you know, the Plattenbaus being built, people moving to better accommodation than they'd had before. It's sort of before things really start falling apart in the 80s.
Yeah, I would say towards the late 80s, yeah. Whereas before, it was nice. We knew, for example, like a television, you had to wait for that as well. And all these items were quite expensive. I still remember when, before we moved into the new building and to a new flat, that we had a really old black and white one, and you had a little transistor next to it that you had to switch that one on first before the telly actually worked. And then we had the first colored television, which was actually a Russian one called Raduga. And it was almost like a heating element at the same time, because it was just getting so hot in the room, and it was humongous. And obviously it broke down quite a few times. And my poor mum had then to help because there was only one engineer coming to help him carry the television up and down the fourth floor when it needed to be repaired in the shop. I mean, that was, it's unthinkable nowadays to carry wow. such heavy thing up and down four floors.
Did you watch much Western TV at home?
You couldn't get it because we were in too far away from Berlin. So we could get a very little bit, but it was really grisly and you really had to listen very, very hard. It's almost like a radio station you can't quite get, and it was all crackled and all that. So you try, well, my dad tried to listen a little bit to hear the other side, as you can imagine. And I noticed that when I was a child, because I was always the first one in after school and got the newspapers. And the newspaper, there were really stories in there, what they just wanted you to know. So you never had both sides. You only ever had that one side. And like in the education, I assume you had the same in the West, but we were taught that the West is really bad and the capitalism is the worst system in the world and this and the other. So it was really politicized. And the same in the papers. You only just got one version. So it was brainwashing in a way, because you didn't have both sides to the coin.
And I've heard similar from, you know, people who lived in the Dresden area, because they were infamous for their lack of TV reception there. I think they were nicknamed the Valley of the Clueless. So yeah, you're quite isolated there, but I presume you could pick up Western radio stations. So did your family listen to those?
Not really, no. I think maybe because we were close to an airport, which was more like a military airport, which was literally just next door to where the area where we lived. Maybe, I don't know if they did on purpose that you couldn't receive the information. That might be a reason. I don't know. And I haven't quite elaborated on that. So I might actually do a wee bit more of research, Ian.
Let me know. I'd be interested to know whether they were actively jamming Western radio. Hi, I'd just like to take a moment to highlight another history podcast that you may enjoy. As you can probably tell, I'm fascinated by German history and not just Cold War history. If that's you too, then I'd like to recommend the History of the Germans podcast by my good friend Dirk Hoffmann Becking. He's creating a comprehensive and accessible audio history of the German peoples, starting in the 10th century with the excellently named King Henry the Fowler. Dirk is some way off reaching the Cold War era, but I've learnt a huge amount. There's amazing stories such as the Teutonic Knights' Battle on the Ice, Frederick Barbarossa, and many more. It's a fascinating journey through German history. The History of the Germans podcast is best summarised by this quote from Geoffrey of Tours, who lived in the 6th century. A great many things keep happening, some good, some bad. You can find a History of the Germans podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts from, or on his website, historyofthegermans.com. Now, back to your episode.
So you mentioned school a moment ago. What was your education like? Do you think East Germany gave you a decent education?
I must say the education we had in East Germany was fantastic. It was very comprehensive. Obviously, take away a bit the political side when it came to, because one course was all about the German state, East German state, and how it all worked. But I must say, the overall education we have received was absolutely amazing. And I noticed that even with people of my same age now, who have grown up elsewhere, may it be the UK, France, or wherever, there is a difference. And that is something I'm really glad that I went through, besides all the political side. Honestly, that the knowledge we got, and in order, because we couldn't drop any courses. So right up when you finished GCSE, you still had done every course. And then even in the A-level, you did all the courses, so that when you then were at that age where you really decided what you wanted to do and maybe a bit more mature what you wanted to do, you didn't have, if you wanted to study medicine and you have dropped chemistry before, that you had to catch up all of a sudden on 2 years of chemistry in A-level. And I think that is something maybe that should be rethought in this curriculum. It is important to have the full education right up to the either GCSE or A-level.
So you really didn't have any much choice in the subjects that you could choose to study then, no, until you were almost ready for university, if that's where you were going.
Yeah. Either you went into apprenticeship after GCSE, after the 10 years, or you went on to do just pure A-level and then studying, or you did a combination, which was called Berufsausbildung mit Abitur, which was an apprenticeship, and at the same time you did your A-level, and then you still carried on studying. So in my case, I did agriculture. So in hindsight, if the wall hadn't come down, I would have gone on to study agriculture further. So usually you stay then within what you have done in your apprenticeship.
What was your favourite subject at school?
I really liked maths, and I think it always comes down to the teachers as well. And the maths teacher we had at school, she was amazing. And I always found maths like a relaxation, to be honest. When I was at college, the majority of my class had English as a second language, because obviously Russian was our first. English as a second foreign language, and we were only three people who had French. So every time we had a French class, it was so intense. I was always pleased when we had maths afterwards, because it was almost like,
oh. Oh, maths, always didn't get on with that subject. Never one of my favourites, that. Probably French neither as well. How's your Russian? Do you remember much of your Russian?
I do remember a bit, so I can still have very basic conversations. I've not practiced it, and like anything, you forget. I can still read it. It's more as if I had just learned how to read, because apart from the basic words, and I would have to look them up as well. And I still remember a bit the grammar. So I think if I was to take it up again, it'll come back. And I did actually go to a Russian class when I moved here to the UK, and did a bit of Russian again. And yeah, but I never really took to that language. It has always been French for me, really.
And why French? What attracted you to French?
I don't know. It was just there. It was just always there. It came out of nowhere.
Did most of your classmates go for English rather than French?
Well, we were actually, in our school, you could choose the second language between French and English, but we were the first year where we couldn't choose anymore. And I don't understand why. Maybe the English teacher moved on, or I don't know why it changed. So for us, it was, if you wanted to do A-level, you had to have a second foreign language. So it was either you do French or you move school. But by that time, you have been with the class, with the same classmates for about 7 years, you don't really want to change school just for that. And so, yeah, I carried on and did French. And then a few class friends, I think we were about five or six, in the ninth year, we decided to do English in the evening class. So that was good fun as well.
Did you find English an easier language or not?
It was a bit easier, definitely. The grammar is a lot easier than French and Russian. And I think once you learn one language properly, any additional language is easier, because something just has clicked in your brain that makes it easier to pick up languages.
Yeah, I've never been a great one for languages, as people will know who regularly listen to the podcast, with my mispronunciations of various words. While you're at school, I'm presuming you had like summer holiday camps as well.
Yes, we did have them, and I went on, I think, two. So they were quite good. And you always had loads of activities there as well. Got eaten by the mosquitoes, obviously, when you were around the fire, the campfire. And so that was just with school. And I went on one because I was part of a singing club. And then we had summer camps, as in training camps, when I was doing rhythmic gymnastics. So we went into the next town, which is called Neustrelitz, and usually have them camps there, and even in the winter time as well. And I remember one winter, I can't remember which year it was, but it was really bitterly cold. It wasn't 79 because that was a really cold winter, but it was later in the 80s. And in East Germany, I think everywhere, it was just so bitterly cold that they had used up most of the coal. So we did the training camp and there was no heating whatsoever. So we were training in a couple of layers and we were sleeping actually with several layers and two girls in one bed just to keep warm. And we had to shower under ice cold water as well.
We'll talk about your gymnastics training in a sec. I mean, with the school-based camps, were there kids from other Warsaw Pact nations there, or was it purely East Germans?
No, there were people from other nations. I'm not so much sure if it was. I know that there were quite a lot of Russians. We had one camp where we were with the Russians. So that was with school, and it was these big army tents, you know, with the bunkbeds. And I think we were about 10 or 12 in the tents. And that's where we mixed. And then you obviously had the opportunity to talk a bit to the Russians and vice versa, because obviously they learned German, we learned Russian. And then you had a few pen friends and then started exchanging letters with them. But that was it, because neither of us spoke fluent, you know, the other language. You couldn't really have a conversation in depth. And I think at that age, she didn't really care too much about what's going on politically, because you were just living, you were bothered about what was happening in your childhood.
Did you get any insight into what the Russian kids' lives were like in the Soviet Union?
Not really, no.
So tell me about the singing club.
Well, the singing club actually started, it started early on because I was self-teaching the recorder. My dad showed me a little bit, and then I was just playing by ear the music and did a bit at school as well. And then I can't remember how it came about. And quite often those people then went round school to see if there's any talent. And then that was there where I was picked up and then joined the singing club. And then during the singing club then came the opportunity as well how to learn how to play the guitar. And it's obviously all these songs were very patriotic, and a few, as we call it, folk songs, you know, Volkslieder. So you had a few of them as well, but everything else was very patriotic, especially in the 80s. It built up more and more about Reagan and obviously the fear of a nuclear war. But that was really good because, again, you were in there and you got taught. So with the guitar, I remember I just turned up at home with a guitar in my hand, and my mum and dad went, "What is this?" Well, I'm learning how to play the guitar. And then I just said, "Oh, I would like to have my own guitar," because they lent it to me. And it was a school, because we had, I don't know how to translate it into English, but we had that system. You know, when you were little, you were a pioneer, and then later on you were an FDR member. So the house where you could do all the activities, that was all sponsored by the government, so parents didn't have to pay a penny, was called Pioneer House. So that's where we had the singing club, and that's where I learned how to play the guitar. And they lent me the guitar, so every 3 months or something, I just had to fill in a piece of paper. And I said, "Oh, I would like to have my own guitar." But Ian, back in the days, you couldn't just go into the one and only music shop we had in town and just go in and say, "I would like a guitar." They got one guitar every 4 months, if that. And then obviously The people working there were selling it, as we call it in German, under the counter. So it went to people they knew. When did I get my first guitar? Quite later on. And it was through my mum's work colleague. They had one. So I got that guitar, they bought it then, so it wasn't brand new either. So yeah, that was quite disappointing that you couldn't just go. And I remember when, because my dad was a teacher and they took a school at the end of the school year to Moscow, you know, for the year-end travel. And there was a space and I was lucky enough to go on there. And we went to Moscow and I couldn't believe it. In one of these massive shopping centers, you went there and there was an absolutely huge wall with the full-sized classic guitars and another huge wall with a sort of miniature guitar size. And I just couldn't believe it. And I thought, why is all this available like this here in Moscow? And yet in East Germany, you can't get it. My fair enough, I can't compare Neubrandenburg with Moscow. Maybe it was available in Berlin, but still that, there were things that highlighted. And I was 13 when we were there, where you thought, why is that readily available there and why is it not where we are?
And these songs which you were singing about nuclear war and Reagan, don't suppose you can remember any of the lyrics?
Yes, but I would have to think about a bit. Yeah, there was one. Do you want me to say it in German?
Or if you can translate it into English, that would be good for me.
So it started more or less, listen to me, Mr. Reagan. Even though I'm still little and almost not visible, but one thing I can see or I realize, and then it went that we children, we want to live and don't want a war in that area. Yeah. And then we want sunshine, you know, all that sort of thing. But yeah, it was literally a song addressed, I think, where there was, when it got really heated between East and West back in the 80s. And that these were the songs I was then singing as well in front of people. So.
Good. And I mean, what sort of music did you listen to? Were you sort of like a Purdy's Kurat fan? Or did you ever hear much Western music? It sounds like you didn't, if you couldn't pick it up on the radio.
No, we didn't really. So it was more the East German people. So the groups were, like you said, Kurat, Purdy's as well. And I can't even remember, there were some other groups as well. So we listened to them, and especially Kurat. Well, Kurat was one of the groups that managed to go abroad and play in the West, whereas Purdy's not so much. And I found their songs actually a lot more subtle, and they criticized. And when you listen to their lyrics, there's quite a lot of subtlety in there where they criticize the state. And there were some other ones. And then later on in the mid-late 80s, you then somehow managed to get a bit more the Western radio as well. And then I think it's the same. I was just saying that to my husband the other day when you were there, and then you had finally your tape recorder and you were listening to the radio, and then always at the end, they started talking into the song.
Yeah, we were doing the same over in the West. We were trying to capture that song, and inevitably the DJ would talk over the intro or the outro as well.
I did actually see the Purdy's in a concert back when I was then at university. So they then had a concert at the Mensa, and that was great having seen them there.
No, they seem to be huge. Did you ever sing any of their songs or try and play them on the guitar and sing them, or did you have to stick to the political ones and the folk songs?
Well, we try to sing those songs, and then people obviously exchanged the lyrics with the chords written by hand above the wordings. You didn't really sing them in officially, you know, in front of people. It was more in smaller groups, amongst friends, that kind of thing. And then at college, yeah, we did it quite often when we sat in the corner, and there was several people who played the guitar who had different songs, and then we just sang different songs and other people joined in. And so yeah, that was quite nice having that. And then obviously once the wall came down, you then had all the other songs coming in, and then we sang quite a few songs of Juliane Werding, for example. She was quite a famous one. So all that was then exchanged.
With your teachers, I mean, inevitably at least one or two of them would be Stasi. Did you ever find out afterwards who they were?
Well, I actually found one out whilst it was still heavily. When was it? 86. I found out, and it was actually the director of the school. And we went, when I was doing the rhythmic gymnastics, we were training, because in East Germany, we had something similar to the Olympics. So every 4 years, we had, it was called Turn- und Sportfest. So it was a gymnastic and sports festival. And that was down in Leipzig. And we always did one part of the opening where we did gymnastic with a prop, and then that gave like a picture to the people who sat in the stadium. And then obviously there was then the competition in athletics and gymnastics and all that. And we were invited because I was part of the group at Dynamo, which was a police sports club in effect. But obviously the police sports club was financed by the state. And we went to present as a small group, just a little bit, in front of the Stasi, and one of the Stasi flocks you would normally not go into. That was one specific building I never set foot in before nor after. And then we went there and did a bit of a presentation, and a few people who were obviously working there. And then I spotted my school director and I thought, what is she doing here? So that was a bit of a surprise, to be honest, because I think you are a bit naive in vertical commas, because you don't think people near you could be part of it.
I mean, if you actually think about how the regime worked, somebody in that position is probably most likely to have some involvement like that. They want somebody trusted there. So, I mean, we've had a few mentions about your gymnastics. Was that the only sport that you were interested in doing?
Yeah, again, that was something. I was always quite supple and flexible, and gymnastics was my preference in comparison to athletics. And they actually, the Dynamo Club people, went round schools to recruit for these events then as well, to train up for those festivals. And they came around the school and they picked, I think, about three of my class. One was already doing the rhythmic sports gymnastics, but then they picked three more of us. And then that's how it all started. And I really liked it. So I started doing it. And then leading up to the festival, which was then in summer 87. And it was then, was it 87? Yeah, it was 87. And it was the last one in effect then, because obviously 89, the wall came down. The training became more and more intense. So we had training 6 times a week. So the only day off was Tuesdays. And then quite often in the holidays, even if we just had a week in autumn or 2 weeks in February, we then went on to these training camps in Neustrelitz, as I mentioned earlier, and did then more intense training really from morning till evening. And so, yeah, it was almost, I imagine that was quite close to a state or stage for people who train to become a professional athlete or gymnast or whatever they are doing. So it was quite intense, to be honest. And then one day, again, we were sharing the room, can't remember, probably 6, 8 of us, big room, the dormitory. And then one day in one of these training camps, the lady who was responsible for the group, they just came with a few tablets and they were all loose. So every one of us got enough. I can't remember how long we stayed there. Might have been a week or 10 days. I can't quite recall. But it was one tablet each day. And they said, take one each day. So there was no package with it. They didn't say what they were for. And back in the days, what do you do? It's an autocratic system where you do what you're being told. So we took it. However, having said that, one of my school friends, she took them all the same day. Not that anything happened to her, but even to this day, I have no idea what they were. Our parents didn't even know about it. I told my mum and dad, many, many years after, and they were absolutely in shock. And my mom said, "You what? They gave you what?" And it's just incredible. I mean, you are a parent. I mean, we weren't even 16 at that stage. How can you dish out things without the knowledge of the parents?
I guess for something like gymnastics, it might be something to try and delay puberty. I mean, you hear all sorts of stories about what the East German government were up to as far as trying to improve performance.
But having said that, the four of us who were at that training camp and were taking those pills, we really, really had massive issues with our periods, as in the strength and the pain we were in as well. And when I look back now, I don't recall anyone else, the other girls who didn't do it, going through the same as us.
So it could have been something around that. I did an episode on the East German doping of athletes, and I know that they did try out some drugs on, you know, sort of people they thought weren't going to necessarily be to Olympic standard, but just to see what effect these drugs had. So, you know, you could have potentially been subject to a drugs trial, but I'm not trying to belittle your chances of winning an Olympic gold there, Circa. Let me just be straight there. I mean, that training regime sounds quite grueling in terms of the intensity of it that you had in that run up to that festival. You really felt that you'd done a full day's training by the end of the day.
Oh, you did, yes. And like I said, we did morning to lunch, then we had lunch, then we did in the afternoon as well. And sometimes when we weren't performing well enough, we had to come back in the evening as well. And the first day when we did this intensive training in comparison to just an hour or so in the evening after school, we were in such agony that we had to walk the stairs from the dormitories down backwards because it hurts less. And it was just, it was tiring. It was really, and I think it's the whole discipline. You didn't dare moving. And I remember we did a group exercise. So we were six, so we had to be synchronized. And if one was out, you knew about it. You know, the music got stopped. And I would just remember we were kind of crouching down from the movements and we all stopped. And there was a girl, her name was Burka and my name is Circa. So you never knew when it was either of us, and we both just shrug at the same time and we realized, was it me or was it the other one? So yeah, it was quite scary, to be honest. And it just reminds me as well, because back then there was that song of Palco that came out, you know, which was about getting a girl that was quite a dark song, and that was literally banned from being played because it didn't sit with the regime. So back then we were able to get a bit more of Western music as well. And I just remember that, oh, switch that off, that will not be played anymore. So it was very much regimented and you knew your place.
And so if you weren't doing what they said you were doing, or you made a mistake, was it very shouty at you, or how did they?
Oh yeah.
So they basically yelled at you, or something like that. Is that the way the training worked?
Yeah, it was very much military style, and if not, yeah, it was very much military style. And if you didn't perform properly, and they kind of felt you did it on purpose, so to speak. Like in the military, the whole group got punished. So you then had to do whatever sit-ups or press-ups or whatever kind of thing. So there was then the punishment, as in further exercise.
So they use collective punishment to stop the individual getting away with it because it would impact on their, you know, their group. So it's, you know, that whole psychological control that I hear a lot in interviews. They're using a bit of psychology as well there to keep you in line.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. Did you ever think about, I can't do this anymore, I'm going to stop?
Funnily enough, no. And I mean, you grow up in that system, and it's not as if you come in from a different system and all of a sudden you've got the shock to it, because school was very much the same. So you were told, and this is how it worked. And because it's been ingrained from such an early stage and early years, you don't think differently. And that's why I understand other cultures and other countries who are still living under that regime, what they are going through. And yeah, now you know the difference between the two. But back then you didn't. That was all you knew. You didn't know what the other side looks like, what it feels like. So yeah, you just made sure you did everything how it should be so that you weren't the one causing all the yelling and causing all the extra exercise.
What were they saying about your performance and where you might end up?
I think because I started quite late, I didn't start at the age of, let's say, 3 or 4 or something like that. When I joined, I can't remember how old I was. I was probably 12, 13, something around that age. So it's quite late. And that was predominantly to get the people in for that sports festival. So I wouldn't have been able to make it anywhere. So we still then competed. So we trained for that presentation, but then we also competed with our own elements, you know, with the ball, with the ribbon and all that, and did competition. I was not, you know, right at the top, because there was always something that didn't quite work how it should have done. And we only did it after school. So it wasn't as if we were, you may have heard from other people, people with high potential in an early childhood went then to a specialist sports school where they did a lot more sports and a bit of school. So they did a lot more, where we were the other way around. We just did it part-time, if you may put it that way.
And they almost wanted you to make up the numbers for this festival.
So I
that
think
you,
so,
you know,
yeah.
So that they had that big spectacle there. Because I've seen these things where the whole pitch is filled full of people.
We were right in the centre of the stadium, which I remember it was in Leipzig, and it was in the summer, and it was, well, we called it actually the Kessel. It was literally like a cauldron. It was so hot and people just keeled over left, right and centre. So we had like the ribbon in sports gymnastics, you know, the small one, but we had a wider one, about 25 centimetres, and that was made of the parachute. What is it called in English again? Zyder.
Silk. Parachute silk.
Silk, thank you. Because it's nice and fluttery. Yeah. And then we had a telescope handle, because then you could do further movements. And then we actually trained with some men from the Dunam, well, from the police who were serving, you know, the back in the days you had to do your army service. So some went into the army, the National Volksarmee, and some did it in the police. And they then, we had a prop as well, they used, so we stood on them and they moved them, for it was sort of a movement with the props, with the people in the middle of the stadium, which was in the opening ceremony, part of the opening ceremony for the actual sports festivity.
And when did you stop doing the gymnastics?
Well, it actually came to a stop when I went to college. I still carried on a bit, because at college where I went, it was a little village and we had a sports hall. So I could actually go get the key and do a bit of training for myself. But it kind of stopped then because I didn't have the opportunity. And I took up then volleyball because that was the sports that was played at college, and then joined the joined the team there.
A while back, you mentioned your trip to Moscow aged 12. What other places did you visit while you were in Moscow?
Well, we did go to a place which was a museum all about their space programs. So you saw all sorts they had there, and it was quite impressive to see it. I can't find the words now, obviously. So you had one of the capsules as well, and everything else. So it was all politicized, as it was back in the days. You know, who was the first one? It was literally the race, and you can still feel and sense it walking through there. And then I think a few years later, I think my dad just looked up on the internet after the war came down, and all that had gone. And that whole museum then was selling secondhand Western cars in Moscow. So obviously, that was no longer required.
Yeah, I saw photos of that. And I think I saw photos where the exhibits were still hanging from the ceiling and all of these secondhand cars were parked underneath or something. Bizarre. Yeah. Did you go and see Lenin?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we did. We had to queue for about 2 hours outside the mausoleum because it was a really long queue. And then went in, and you had to keep on walking, so you were not allowed to stand still. So if you imagine, you've got the square glass box where he's lying in front of you, so you walked towards his feet and then on one side round and then back out again. So I was just kind of walking a bit backwards to have a bit longer time to walk back with some other people of that spot, school class. It was strange to obviously see him lying there, and when you think for how long he's been there as well, and especially because he was really idolized, especially in Eastern Germany, and loads of books were read, and the way it was being, because obviously he was one of the founders besides Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, but he was really, really idolized. And only now, watching some documentaries, what happened in Russia in those days gives me the other side to the coin. And you just believe at school what you learn. And that was part of the Russian class as well. So you learned the language as well as all the political side from it. So yeah, that was quite an experience. Strange, but yeah.
It's incredible he's still there, even now in 2024.
Have you been seeing it, Ian?
I haven't, no. I've never been to Russia, and it doesn't look like I'll be going there anytime soon either. My parents went to Moscow in 1979, I think it was. And they... So you go to college in a place called Halberstadt near Magdeburg. And as you said before, it's agriculture that you're studying.
Yeah.
There. What is it like there? I mean, do you have the latest and greatest in East German agricultural machinery to practice on? I imagine perhaps not.
Of course not. And actually, it was outside of Halberstadt in a little village called Bönshausen. So I think the number of people living there, or the majority, was us when we were at school in college. No, it wasn't the latest machines. Obviously, the combine harvesters, the tractors, they were all of a certain age. I think the combine harvesters had at least 10 years, if not more. There was constantly something breaking down and needed to be repaired. But it taught you quite a lot to check this, to check that. And we had East German combine harvesters, East German tractors, and Russian tractors. And the Russian tractors were just a nightmare. I hated them driving because you had two gear sticks. You had one for the group and one for the actual gear, so that you can obviously change if you need more torque for being on the field rather than driving on the road. And then I still remember when we had on the little paths, we then learned how to drive those tractors, and you had to rev up in order to change. And by the time you managed to change it, and we literally were standing on the clutch and trying to get the gear in And then the rev has just come back down. So there was no chance getting that gear in. And it was just so frustrating to do it. But it was really good to learn the ins and outs. And I just remember one incident we had as well with the combine harvester. It was quite old. So we were a couple of students where our delegation company, so we were sponsored a little bit by one company. So one was obviously in Neubrandenburg where I had my contract with, but they didn't have any fields or combine harvesters, but it was conditioned that we did a season at least learning the ropes of it. So a couple of students, we stayed at the college site and learned it there. And then we had our combine harvester. And I remember the guy who was overseeing us from the cooperative back then was going up into the engine room and having a look what is what. And then I was inside the cabin and all of a sudden you just heard that massive bang and then switch the engine off. So I quickly had, it was behind me. I had to switch the engine off. And actually one of the piston has broken through the metal of the body of the engine and blew out a piece about 15 by 15 centimeters and it literally flew a couple of centimeters past his head.
Wow.
I mean, you can understand now why there's so many accidents in agriculture as well. So anyway, at the end of the season, we wrapped it up and gave it to him as a present, as a reminder.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And I think you had some visitors from Russia there.
Yes. Yeah, we did. That was at school time. So there was a delegation from Russia coming and just having a look, being taken around. And then when they went to see the tractors and especially the combine harvesters, they were absolutely in awe because they thought, oh my God, with the cabin, because they were still driving even all the machines to us with open cabins. And I mean, even with the cabin, the amount of dust you had in your nose, on your skin was incredible. I mean, obviously there wasn't any aircon as such, it was just ventilation. But I wouldn't want to imagine even for once if you had sat all day on an open combine harvester. So yeah, they were quite surprised in what better condition our machines were in comparison to theirs. And when you think Russia is the, or was the big brother, you would have thought it would have been the other way around.
So they're impressed by how modern the equipment was that you were using. Wow. Wow. I mean, we're sort of moving into 88, 89 territory now.
Yep.
Did you sense anything that change was coming or there was unrest within East Germany?
So where we stayed, not so much because we were in such a tiny village and isolated. You didn't really. But we did have a TV room at college. So obviously we went in there and watched the news and you could see that things were building up, especially down in Leipzig, and things were moving more and more and more. So obviously every night then leading up to the event in 89, we were watching on a regular basis and you kind of did get the sense something is going to happen. So I only traveled home, I think, every 4 or 8 weeks because it took almost, 10, 12 hours to get home and back again. So you didn't have much from a weekend. So we were all talking a little bit and everyone was, well, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? But nobody would have ever, ever imagined that it leads to the outcome that we have seen. And I think for us, well, me personally, I can obviously only speak about myself. I think Gorbachev had a really big role. And without him, I don't think it would have happened. I think without him, it probably would have turned a lot more bitter.
I think you're right. I think if the Soviets had decided that they weren't going to let these Warsaw Pact countries go their own way, then, you know, they would have used military force to, just as they had in 1953. In East Germany, to put it down. So I think he is pivotal. I mean, obviously you've got Poland, where the free trade union Solidarity has been reinstated or legalized again this time. And Solidarity, I think, have their first semi-free elections in June 89. And obviously, Eric is not too happy about what's happening over there. But, you know, I think also, you know, looking at it with hindsight, is the country was going bankrupt. So, yeah, you know, they were so much in debt to the West, and, you know, it was inevitable that something was going to happen. I think none of us expected how rapidly it would all change.
I mean, when we had elections, surprisingly, meaning that ironically, obviously, he always won with 100%. I mean, that might remind us of some other countries where things happen that way still to this day. We never really knew much about what the real situation was, because as I said earlier, the paper only told you what they wanted you to know. So we were always fulfilling 100% fulfillment of our plan, blah, blah, blah. The only positive thing what I've experienced as a child was obviously we never had in the family, or no family had ever had that fear of losing their jobs. And that is a different upbringing, and having obviously access to what you want to explore as a child. You know, do I like gymnastics, or do I like sports, or do I like crafting things or music or whatever, that you could do it, that it wasn't all depending on how much purchase power your parents had. That was a really good upbringing, because you had that assurance. The jobs of your mum and dad were still there. You're not going to lose your home. You're not going to lose your education. You know, you had your doctors and everything. That was one positive thing I have to say, which helps a lot, I think, to grow and find out what it is you want to do. Now, on the flip side, seeing that can't work on the long term, I see that from a financial and economic side. But that was the positive I've definitely taken away from there.
And you're not the only voice that I've heard that from. I presume you're watching these demos on the Western TV channels, because at Magdeburg you'd be able to pick them up from there. Or was East German TV showing these demonstrations as well?
That's a good point. I think it was Western television. Yeah, because we went far to Goslar. You know, we were just on the other side of the Harz, the mountain. And yes, because I remember we did, and we always had someone when the people who looked after us, not the teachers, you know, I can't remember what you call it. German is Erzieher. And then it went always quick, quick, and someone had to jump and change the channel so that they don't see that we were watching Western TV, because they couldn't block it as such. But yeah, that was quite funny. You're right. So it was probably more on the other side that we saw more and more. And we did ask the question at school. And in hindsight, I feel sorry for those teachers. We asked the question. How were they supposed to know? They were just in the known as much as we were, or in the unknown, shall I say.
I mean, did you watch many Western soap operas while you were at college or not? Was it just little snippets of Western TV?
I think it was more little snippets. We didn't watch that much TV, to be honest. I think we were still doing a lot more activities. Like I said earlier, quite a lot of us were playing volleyball, or you went out for a walk or did things. I didn't watch a lot of telly. It was more towards the end, or towards 89, 88. Well, I started 88, so 89 that year. What went on, and everyone was there waiting what the next day brings.
Where were you when you heard that the wall had opened? One of my favourite questions, this.
Well, so I was at college. And we shared the dormitory we were four girls sharing a dormitory. And I remember, obviously, as you said, we were watching in the evenings what was going on. And in the morning, we got ready for school, had the radio on as usual, listened to the news. And then all of a sudden, as we were kind of getting dressed, getting ready, it was announced that the wall had been opened in Berlin. And I remember that as if it was yesterday. All four of us, we stopped in our tracks what we were doing. We all sat down and you kind of thought, oh my God, what's going on? And I remember one of the girls in my room, she lived in Potsdam, which is just outside of Berlin. And she was the first one speaking. She said, oh, great. I'm going to go to West Berlin this weekend. And I think it may have been a Thursday or Friday or something. It was quite close to the weekend. I can't quite remember which day it was. So she was the only one excited. The rest of us, because we were staying that weekend still at the place there, we were like, right, well, what is that now going to mean? So I got ready for school, went into school again, bombarding all the teachers with all these questions. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to our, what do you call it, education? Is that going to be recognized? Are we still going to finish our apprenticeship? What's going to happen with our A-leveled? So obviously all these questions now, all of a sudden, that security, that safety net was all of a sudden removed. And there was just, if you look at it, just a gaping, deep valley there. And you didn't know how far we're going to fall, what is going to happen. It was quite daunting when you think we were only sort of 17. It's quite early. Yes, you're already adult enough, but still, it's quite shocking, you know, when all of a sudden your security has been taken. And one specific aspect I remember, we had a teacher, as I mentioned earlier, when we were going through my school time, he was teaching the course, which was all about the East German state and Staatsbürgerschaft, you know, all the political side. So he was of a certain age. And I remember he was talking when he was in the Nazi Jugend, because back then he was young. He believed that was the right thing to do, but you can't fault people for it until you've lived in exactly the same situation yourself. Then the Second World War came, and he obviously then believed, yes, that was the right thing, and the socialism is the way forward, and got really engaged, and that was his conviction. When the wall came down, we did not see that man again. I think for him, the whole world probably properly broke down, because when you think he's been through the thing twice to be proven wrong again. So yeah, that was quite shocking when we said, well, what happened to Mr. I can't remember his name, such and such. He was never been seen again.
I'd love to speak to somebody who was a real hardcore believer in the state. And, you know, speak to them about their experiences at that time and how that felt. Because essentially your whole world, your whole belief structure is, you know, running like sand through your fingers. I mean, East Germany doesn't cease to exist when the wall opens. East Germany sort of staggers on for another 18 months, I think it is, or possibly less than that. But, you know, I'd really love to speak to somebody who, you know, experienced that, who was a real believer in real and existing socialism, I think, as it was described. Can you remember the first time you went into, was it West Germany or West Berlin was your first view of the West?
I think we went... It wasn't West Berlin, because I had a boyfriend at the time who lived near Halberstadt, and I think we may have gone over, you know, on that side from the Harz into, and I remember because we had the 100 Deutschmark greeting money, as they call it,
Begrüßungsgeld.
Yeah. And it felt odd. We all went because obviously, wow, hard cash, you know, Deutschmark and all that. I felt awful as I stood in that queue to get my 100 Deutschmark. It didn't sit right with me, but still this, I don't know if it is peer pressure because everybody else did it, you did it, or because you didn't have it for all your life, you did it. I don't know. I think sometimes you just follow things even though it's not quite sitting right with you. And I felt humiliated in a way. I felt, I don't know how to put it into words. It just felt belittled. You know, you just didn't feel as an individual. You were just one of these East German burghers, East German citizens, going there for a bit of pity.
Yeah, it's like charity. And what did you make of the West? What did you see there? Did it live up to what you thought it would be like or not?
Well, it did to a degree, because back in the school time, we were taught that obviously it's a lot of people that are struggling to live in the capital. It's been obviously put on that spectrum. They never told you about the one where it works well. They always obviously go with the extremes. And I remember when we first walked through, was obviously all the advertisement, a lot more colours and all that, because it was quite grey and dim back in East Germany and everything was the same. It didn't matter where you travel to, you got the same choice, more or less. Maybe not so much in Berlin, maybe you had a bit more there. But then the prices and everything was the same. So you could see there all the advertisement, which we are not used to. And I remember the people on the street sat there begging for money. And then I think what struck me as well, and I don't want it to sound prejudiced or anything, was the sheer amount of Turkish people around, because we were not used to it, you know, because we didn't have that many foreigners coming in and out the country, unless they were from another socialist country. These were sort of the things, not shocking, but had an imprint on me.
Yeah, different. Because I think on East German TV, you had the black channel, the Schwarzer Kanal, which showed probably the worst of the West to try and deter people from wanting to leave East Germany. And I remember, I think one of my early episodes, I spoke to somebody who their first experience of West Berlin was going into Kreuzberg and was quite shocked by the litter and the graffiti and, you know, how different it was. I mean, how did the rest of your year go? Because, you know, 89, the wall opens, you cross over, have a look. Do you stay at the college or what happens with you?
Yeah, we stayed at college. So you came back to college. And as you said earlier, it just stayed the same for quite a while. Everything in the shops, everything just stayed the same. And then bit by bit, things changed. So in the village where the building where the girls had the dormitory, there was a little shop underneath, so which was kind of the little shop for the people who lived in the village as well to buy their essentials without going into Halberstadt. Bit by bit, that changed. So all of a sudden, that shop where you could buy anything became a shop, because obviously we were all young people at college and the majority of the people living in the village. You had then chocolate bars over chocolate bars over chocolate bars. The shop consisted almost entirely just out of all this junk food. So you couldn't buy now anymore milk or whatever kind of thing. It was just literally that kind of thing, those products. Things didn't change that quickly. I think it was then gradually. There isn't a fine cut where I can say, oh, this is the date or the year where things all of a sudden changed. So we carried on. Then was still the question that was clarified, what's going to happen with our education? And then came obviously the enlightenment, or we all realized, well, I don't think a majority of us will be going and study agriculture as we had planned. Because as you know, back in East Germany, everything was cooperative, subsidized by the government. So there wasn't any private farmers as such. Some who were from family history obviously got some of the land back and started their business. And I know even, I think, two of my parallel class have carried on and are, as we call it, Landwirte. So they are still working their business in agriculture. And then was the big question, okay, well, let's do the A-level, but what am I going to do next? So what are we going to study? And my thought was then just, well, might as well study economics to learn fast and furious how the new system works. That was a bit of a shock to the system as well when I started university, because you had lecturers from the West that came to teach and professors, but they had lived all their lives in the capitalism. We have only just been in the capitalism for what, a year and a bit? And all of a sudden you had pricing strategy and all these sort of things. We were like, what? Marketing? It was all new to us. And I think that is what was difficult for people to get their head around, that all of a sudden in the country, the price is not the same. You had to shop around and see, you know, obviously there's a special offer, so I'm saving that money. Or that you didn't have to bother about it. The piece of butter was the same, as I said earlier, no matter if you bought it in the north, south, east or west.
And people trying to sell you stuff, you know, potentially people coming over from the west selling you stuff that you don't actually need, but saying that you do need it. So do you remember when the Ostmark was replaced by the Deutschmark?
I don't really have vivid memories of that, to be honest. I remember more when the euro came in.
Yeah. The vote on reunification with West Germany, were you in favour of that?
I'm not sure if I voted, to be honest, but somehow I seem to have a bit of a hole there.
Well, you were at college, so you were probably partying or something like that, I guess.
I don't think, did we vote? I can't remember. Were we allowed to vote? Because you were only allowed to vote when you were 18.
So you weren't yet 18 at that point?
No, we were not quite, no. Yeah, for some reason, that is interesting, Ian.
How did your parents fare post-Wende?
They were okay in comparison to some other people, because after the wall came down quite a bit, quite a few businesses then, as you know, got shut down or bought for one Deutschmark by people, and then they shut it down. So my mum and dad were really lucky, because both of them stayed in their jobs and kept their jobs. So they didn't experience, like other, straight away being unemployed. So that was good. So we did still have the security there, and it didn't really hit us as much. So that allowed me then to go to university and study, whereas I think people who had lost their jobs, it's put that a bit into jeopardy. So that wasn't bad. I just remember that after the war came down, a lot of people then who did have a job and quite a secure job started building their own homes. And then as things moved on, and obviously the market fluctuating, some of them then had to sell their home because they couldn't pay the mortgage anymore. And my mum and dad made the conscious decision that they're going to stay in that flat and pay rent rather than building their own home. Because, I mean, my sister, even though she was 4 years younger than me, I haven't really gone back home. So she was the only one living then at home. Where's the point starting a big house then when the kids are out of the house? And I think that's where they still say to this day that they are glad they did it that way, even though they may have probably paid a bit more because of the rent and not having quite the home they would have had if they had built it. But at least you haven't ended up in debt.
So they're still living in the same flat to this day?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's always funny when I go back. It's definitely going back, and memories are coming back. And it was quite good, actually. Last year in November, we had a class reunion, Ian, and the majority of our class met. And I haven't seen many of them for quite a while. And so we actually hired the really old Icarus bus, the round one, you know, not the box one. And because one of my classmates' brother can drive it. So we did a bit of a tour and who remembers who used to live here. And some people, the buildings, the blocks where they used to live are not there anymore. They're being all knocked down because people have left. So many people have left the town. And then this is where that was. And our school doesn't exist anymore. There is now, a home for elderlies. So, but it was quite nice to relive a bit the memories. And it kind of brings the memories back every time I go and visit my parents, because it's still the same place.
It must be strange, sort of, I guess, walking to that flat, you know, where you walked as a child, you know, in the 1970s, but the block's still there, but see massive change in other parts of the town. With your father, I mean, he was a member of the party, so I guess I'm surprised that he kept his job, because it would appear that he was a loyal communist by being a party member. Did that party membership affect his future career in any way?
I don't think so. I mean, we haven't spoken in detail about it. He wasn't, when you say active, yes, he was a member, but he wasn't as active as other people. So he wasn't, you know, one that was constantly, how can I put it, promoting that side of the party. And I think because it stayed within and it was more or less the same people still doing the jobs, there were worst cases and they couldn't just let, and I would have guessed that there are quite a few teachers that would have been party members. If you had to let all of them go, then all of a sudden there would have been a huge shortage of teachers. And his classes, or what he taught, was maths, physics and astronomy. So that is not influenced by any political system.
Did either your mother and father take a look at their Stasi files?
Yeah, so they asked for it, and apparently my dad had one. And he got a letter back, and he showed it to me last time I went. And it didn't say much about it, so he could have then asked for the actual file to be sent. And I don't know why he didn't pursue it. So maybe there wasn't a lot in there, or maybe because it came to the point and thought, well, does it really matter going forward? You know, because it wouldn't have had an effect. And I don't know. Yeah, I think now he regrets that he hadn't requested that actual file. Would have been quite interesting just to see what they kind of put in there, what they thought they had seen, and how they came to any conclusions, maybe. But I think it's too late now.
Yeah, I'm always intrigued because, you know, I get some people who say, no, didn't want to have a look at it because I don't want to know what's in there, because let's just let sleeping dogs lie. I don't want to know if friends informed on me or relatives for that matter. And also, I think people that have got their file have been surprised at how inefficient the Stasi actually was. Like, you know, they've missed the fact that their uncle came over from West Germany. You know, that's not in there. But they have picked up some minor, really boring piece of trivia. So they weren't, you know, the Stasi wasn't necessarily this omnipresent, efficient secret police. They did collect a lot of, you know, useless information.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.